Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Today on the Charlie Kirk Show, we have an in-depth sit-down with Congressman Dan Crenshaw. We talk philosophy. I ask him, does he actually even enjoy being in Congress? And I ask him another question. Are people naturally good or naturally bad? You are going to want to hear this answer. It's an in-depth, exclusive interview unlike any he has ever done before here on The Charlie Kirk Show. Please email me questions that I can ask our guests. In recent episodes, we've had Nikki Haley, Governor Kristi Noem, Donald Trump Jr., and many others. You can email me directly to ask these questions to our guests, freedom@charliekirk.com. Take out your phone, open your email tab, and type in freedom@charliekirk.com. It goes straight to me before going to our team. And also, one more thing before we get started. Type in Charlie Kirk Show to your podcast provider. Hit that subscribe button. Charlie Kirk Show, hit that subscribe button. Help us surge in the charts right now. We are just about beating Joe Biden. If you guys hit that subscribe button, we can do that. Buckle up, everyone. Great episode in store. Here we go.
Charlie, what you've done is incredible here.
Maybe Charlie Kirk is on the college campus.
I want you to know we are lucky to have Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk's running the White House, folks.
I want to thank Charlie. He's an incredible guy. His spirit, his love of this country. He's done an amazing job building one of the most powerful youth organizations ever created, Turning Point USA.
We will not embrace the ideas that have destroyed countries, destroyed lives, and we are going to fight for freedom on campuses across the country. That's why we are here.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this episode of The Charlie Kirk Show. I'm sitting next to Congressman Dan Crenshaw. How are you doing,
Dan? Good to be with you, Charlie.
Good. We've sat before, and I want to make this a little bit different of a podcast and just kind of ask questions that we might get into a little bit of policy, a little bit of current events. But I have a question I ask all members of Congress, sometimes on the podcast, sometimes not. Do you enjoy being a congressman?
Oh, yeah. It's a good question. I get that question all the time. I get two questions all the time. Are you enjoying it, and what surprises you the most? And the second one's very hard. I actually don't know what surprises me the most. Was that your next question?
Well, I have a different question, which is, are there really like lobbyists waiting with barrels full of cash behind
right,
every corner?
Right. Wouldn't that be something? So am I enjoying it? Yes. And I have to define what it means to enjoy something. And for me, that means fulfillment. You know, mm-hmm. I do feel like I'm living with my sense of purpose. I feel like I have a mission. And that's, I think, true joy. Is it enjoyable? Like, you know, blowing things up and jumping out of airplanes was enjoyable. Like, no, it's not. That was really fun. That was my old life, of course, in the SEAL teams, which also offered me a sense of fulfillment. So it's not fun in that sense. However, and I think you could probably glean this from my general public persona. I do like being in the fray. I do like the fight. I like combating, in the spectrum of ideals and I do enjoy it.
Well, so I have to say, you more than most politicians, you actually talk about ideas. It's not just Republican versus Democrat. You actually try to get into the root of a lot of these principles and thinkers and philosophers. Mm-hmm. You went to a pretty good school.
Yeah.
Right? And
the Texas A&M of the East.
Yeah, exactly. which, of course, Harvard. Did you have a passion for this sort of stuff from the beginning of your schooling? Because we have a lot of young people listening to this podcast.
Yeah.
Did you just find a passion for where did these ideas come from? You know, what does it mean to exist as a human being? Because I hear you talk about a lot of that.
Right.
And to be honest, watching a lot of your content, it actually seems like you're more passionate about that than talking about corporate tax policy.
Yeah. Well, I have to tell people where the corporate tax policy comes from. And see, this is where we failed as Republicans, I think, for a very long time is and you mentioned this briefly in your question, where this sort of Republican versus Democrat. But OK, what does that mean? Like, let's unpack that for a second. I think in simplified terms, what you're noticing, what you're observing, and I think what a lot of voters see and observe is this tendency for both sides to just try to convince the voter that the other side is bad. And worse in some way, like on a character level, not necessarily even a policy level, but on a character level, because you see all this political sniping about, who's had the most affairs and like who's lied the most amount of times. And like, yeah, that information isn't irrelevant. It's not trivial, but it's also not the most important thing. And, you know, like when you when you're trying to persuade somebody to vote for a political party, you should be trying to persuade them to vote for that party based on the ideas, the foundational ideas and the framework of governance that that party represents. Does everybody in that party always going to represent it perfectly? No. Are you going to find hypocrisy? Yes, of course. You know, but that doesn't change the overall thrust of the foundational frameworks with which we're trying to govern. And that's why I talk about that so much, because again, you just noted this. It's one thing to talk about corporate tax policy. That is really important. But I have to explain to the voter how I got to that point. You know, the sort of the foundations of liberty and, mm-hmm. and free market ideals that lead to this policy that it's not just some giveaway to these rich evil corporations and Scrooge McDuck's just diving into big sure. pools of money. There's a reasoning behind that, and there's a deeper reasoning about owning your own labor, being able to reap the benefits of your production and of your success. You know, and I think just reminding people of those more deeper societal underpinnings are really important.
Well, let's focus on that then for a second. What thinkers really got you along that path from a young age? Because people say, well, Charlie, what should I read? I say, well, you got to read the classics first, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, Descartes, Cicero, Marcus Aurelius. But the chances are they're really—
easier said than done.
Well,
yeah.
Right. I mean—
at least get the Cliff Notes.
Or at least know what they stood for at the very least, right?
Right. Yeah, because, you know, I've been told that I'm more of a concept person, less of a historian. So I'm going to have a lot of trouble telling you exactly which philosopher said what, but—
I think that's less relevant.
It is less relevant. And, you know, I can't remember what year something happened. My mind doesn't work that way. Some people's minds works that way. Mine doesn't. But what I am good at is conceptual memorization, I guess. It might be the way to frame that. And so I agree with you. I think you should read, or at least the Cliff Notes on a lot of these things, just so you understand where these ideas came from. You know, Ben Shapiro's book, The Right Side of History, does a quick but thorough, digestible deep dive into old philosophy from Athens and Jerusalem and the connection between reason and religion and why that's important for Western civilization. But I guess I didn't really answer your other question, which was, what do I read and how did I even get interested in becoming a member of Congress? And it happened over time. I was definitely not political at a young age. So you started Turning Point, what, at 18?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So at 18, no, I did not even think about doing anything like that. At 18, the only thing I cared about was getting into college and getting into BUDS, you know, into SEAL training. That's 100% all I cared about. You wouldn't have even – I think I was naturally conservative, mostly because I think it's self-evident that conservatives and liberals are psychologically wired differently.
I want to get into that in a sec.
We can. That's one of the, I love talking about the psychology of the right and the left. I think we should be exploring that a lot more.
There's huge green space
as a movement.
There.
And so I think I was always wired that way, but that doesn't mean I even understood the political party differences. I didn't care. You know, I was 100% focused on this goal at this time. I cared a lot more about it later on in life, mid-20s, late-20s. And a couple things stood out to me. Again, I was already conservatively wired. But what I would also notice is anytime I looked into an issue or anytime you see kind of the first layer of an issue or a political topic, every time I looked into it and maybe read up on some read into some think tanks or just read some articles on it, it turned out that the conservative side overwhelmingly would have more layers to it and actually be way more persuasive, whereas the left-leaning side generally stopped only a couple layers deep and then was ultimately not very persuasive. And so there's this sort of slow, I guess, reaffirming of my predispositions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that happened over time. But again, I still was not very political. I got to Harvard still not very political. So this is the end of my career in the military. Now, I got to Harvard clearly stating I'm a conservative.
So you went to Harvard after your service?
Yeah, yes, okay. Sorry. So I went to Tufts, my undergrad.
In Boston.
In Boston, yeah. Just, you know.
Not everyone knows that, though.
I know. And I have no connection to Boston. So I went to Tufts because I was always interested in policy.
Mm-hmm.
I did international relations at Tufts. You know, I grew up abroad because my dad was in the oil and gas sector. So I grew up in Houston.
And you speak fluent Spanish.
Yeah. And so I went to high school in Bogota, Colombia, and You know, did Model UN as a kid. So I was like, I was all into international affairs. I figured that would be a good major. And I minored in physics just because. I don't know why. There was no reason for that. It was just I figured that's what I would do if I wanted to pretend to be a smart kid. And which I guess that's a whole different story. But so I got to Harvard at the end of my military career. I knew I wanted to remain in policy. And so I went to the Kennedy School. I didn't go to business school. I didn't go to law school. I went to the Kennedy School. Wanted to study policy and then, you know, find a new path in that direction. Not politics, but policy. And there is a difference just for – and this is maybe important for kids to understand because you get asked about this a lot. Like, how do you get involved? How do you get into the political sphere?
I get that question hourly.
And I say the first thing you have to differentiate is whether you're interested in policy or politics. There is a difference. If you're interested in policy, I would suggest that usually means you're interested in a certain type of policy. Okay, maybe it's – you know, I don't know. Maybe it's labor or something. Maybe it's small business development. Like I don't know. I don't know whatever it is for you. But maybe get really smart on that one piece of policy. Maybe work for a politician. Maybe work for a think tank. Maybe that's your thing. Maybe it's behind the scenes. If you're interested in a whole bunch of different policies and you want to have a kind of a broader effect in that way, then you do have to get into politics a little mm-hmm. bit more. And I found more and more that that's where I was at. I still wasn't thinking about running because there was no path to running. Okay, I don't have any money. I don't know a lot of people with money. I didn't know anybody with money, really. And there wasn't really a clear window of opportunity. There wasn't a clear place that I would run for office. And so you have to have one of those three things, and I didn't have any of them. But my wife and I did talk about running just kind of casually. And then all of a sudden one day, maybe probably at least 4 or 5 months, 6 months after I graduated from Harvard, I was actually about to take a job, a policy job at the Department of Defense, and then the next day I was running for Congress. It just happened that fast because the third thing opened up, which
is
a window of
opportunity. This is after your service to the SEALs?
Yep, yep. Okay. Yeah, this is 10 years in the SEAL teams. Yeah, obviously I'm jumping around a lot, but 10 years in the SEAL teams and going to Harvard. And I think being at Harvard, again, I went in there wearing conservatism on my sleeve. Well, I'm super outspoken about it. But,
so
but
you
if
were
people,
a Navy SEAL that went to Harvard?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
See, I didn't know that. I thought you went to Harvard and then went to officer training.
Nope. Yeah, I did my master's
just
there.
The misimpression I had.
Post-military okay. masters. And so.
Because you're such an underachiever.
Yeah, no, it's Harvard. They'll take anybody.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
It was an interesting experience. So I was definitely more political by the time I got out of the SEAL teams. Mm-hmm. And like you can look at my history on I've never deleted any, and mostly because I was running for office and I wanted some kind of history just to make sure people knew what I was about. You know, you look at my personal Facebook account, like you'll see that I get more political over time. I remember, I was like one of the first people in America to have Facebook because I was at Tufts.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So you had a .edu, Upper East Coast,
yes,
elitist
exactly.
Boston metro area.
Yeah, yes.
Email.
Exactly.
So when Mark Zuckerberg had the Facebook.
Right. I was the third school to have it. Was at Tufts.
Yeah, it's so funny.
So I've had it for a long time. So you can kind of, you can almost watch my political upbringing right there on my Facebook page. And by the time I got to Harvard, like I said, I wore conservatism on my sleeve, not in some kind of hardcore way by any means. I wasn't like trying to debate everybody in class. You know, I'm just trying to learn. And I learned a lot, right? and I think it was an extremely beneficial year, especially in hindsight, because you learn so much about the liberal bubble. You learn so much about what the intellectual leftists actually think and how little they understand conservatism.
Did you learn about the left, or did you learn things that you think are more valuable for human beings to learn in college? Or both?
Both. I mean, I still defend the institution, the Kennedy School. I think conservatives can find what they're looking for there, mm-hmm. policy-wise. I think you'll find a lot of good stuff. You know, some of the best conservative economists are...
Arthur Brooks is there now?
Yeah, that's right. Arthur Brooks is there right now.
He's terrific.
Martin Feldstein, you know, he has since passed, and God bless him. But it's hard to imagine a better economics class mm-hmm. than what that guy puts on. And there's other... good economist. I just interviewed one on my podcast, Ed Glaser. So, you know, talking about city innovation and like there's great thinkers there. I mean, the student body is just like everywhere is becoming more radicalized, but I still defend the institution. You can find what you're looking for mm-hmm. there.
The last few months have taught us what is important in life. It also taught us what we need to eliminate or change. It's the same for business. What are the changes that you need to make? Do you have a hairball of multiple software systems? I know I did before I came aware of NetSuite.com. And you have to ask yourself the question, when could you stream online with one? All you need is NetSuite by Oracle. They're amazing. NetSuite by Oracle is the world's number one cloud business system. Finance, HR, inventory, e-commerce, everything you need all in one place. So you save time, money, and headaches. Whether you're doing a million or hundreds of millions in sales, NetSuite gives you the visibility and control so you can manage every penny with precision. Join over 20,000 companies who trust NetSuite to go faster with confidence. NetSuite surveyed hundreds of business leaders and assembled a playbook of the top strategies they're using as Americans reopen for business. Receive your free guide, 7 Actions Businesses Need to Take Now, and schedule your free product tour at netsuite.com/Kirk. Get your free guide and schedule your free product tour now, right now at netsuite.com/Kirk. That's netsuite.com/Kirk.
So I want to zero in on something you said, which is psychologically you think there's a difference between conservatives and liberals. I think there's been some great thinking and some great writing on this, but not enough. Jonathan Haidt, I think, has some of the best analysis on this, where
that's where I usually point to.
I think he's done the most kind of frontier work on this, where he talks about how conservatives are more likely to want to recognize something that works and protect that something, and that at least liberals, not leftists, they're much more likely to take personal and individual, not risk, that's not the right term, but they're on their hierarchy of needs and demands, they're completely different.
Yeah.
So go ahead if you want to comment on that.
Yeah. So Jonathan Haidt talks about the different moral foundations. So he's a moral psychologist. And the specific pillar that you're referring to is the kind of loyalty to in-groups.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why it's – and this manifests in policy rather quickly. It's more likely a conservative is going to say, yeah, we should have some kind of border. You know, we should have some kind of nationality. It's okay to say that we are a nation, right? And increasingly on the left, you're seeing the exact opposite. The multiculturalist ideal pops up a lot more on the left. Why? Because they're more – you know, they're more open, right? And, you know,
well, allegedly.
Yeah. Well, open in a certain way.
That's where I disagree with Haidt on some things. But
well,
yeah.
I don't know that you disagree with him. I think again, we're talking in total generalities.
Of course.
Here. He's not saying that they're open because he's one of the biggest critics of the left on as far as open mindedness. But there's a difference between open mindedness and an openness to this out group. Mm-hmm. And so I think they are open to outgroups, just not ideological outgroups.
And I think they're vocally, but also in practice, very few leftists actually are the first ones to want to get out of their gated communities and send their kids to public schools.
The hypocrisy is very obvious to us, right? But as far as the wiring, though, because – and I think that hypocrisy stems from just the political influence that they exert on themselves. But – left free of the blue and red jerseys, I think they would supposedly be more open. Right now, as Haidt points out, like that's ultimately detrimental to a society. You can't be so open that you just always let everything in.
No, the extrapolation of that is decay and destruction.
Right. It is, and so they're just much more likely to again love multiculturalism. If a part of our town all of a sudden speaks a different language and engages in totally different cultural values, they'll say, yay, diversity. But conservatives are more likely to say, oh, maybe we didn't want that. Like, you know, maybe if we wanted that, we would just go visit that other place. Mm-hmm. And so, again, it's a difference in how we're wired. And so that's just one thing. He talks about the caring and kindness attributes. He talks about kind of a sense of authority, a sense of rule of law. He talks about a sense of sanctity. Like there's – in this – can't go into all of these. I'd really recommend this book, The Righteous Mind. I mean, I think it should be required reading for all conservatives. Heterodox Academy is very cool. I've had him. He's one of my favorite thinkers. I mean, by far. And he wrote The Coddling of the American Mind more recently with Greg Lukianoff, and that's just a phenomenal book as well. Again, I love any book that dissects the psychology of how people think. Mm-hmm. Like, let's really dive into this. I reference him all the time in my book too. Fortitude, American Resilience in the Era of Outrage, just for anybody trying to buy it. We probably can.
You should check it out, and we can promote it freely and openly here on the Charlie Kirk Show.
So that's really important. There's other ways, too, that I think, you know, Jordan Peterson, those are the moral psychology parameters. And there's a couple other interesting observations about Jonathan Haidt's research, which is this. There's a website you can go to. I think it's called yourmorals.org. I didn't even know we were going to talk about Jonathan Haidt. This is, just shows how much I love his work. Like, I really know everything about it.
It's good.
You can go to yourmorals.org and you can take these surveys on seeing where you score on these different – on five different parameters. And what the most interesting thing to me was his findings, which were the following. So you take your score and you're a self-identified liberal or conservative, and then you're asked the same questions, and you're asked, okay, how would the other side answer this? If you're a conservative, how would a liberal answer this? If you're a moderate, how would a liberal answer this? Mm-hmm. And how would a conservative answer this, et cetera? And what you find is this. The further left they are, the less accurate they are with a conservative answer. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. They basically mean if people on the left have no idea what conservatives think. In fact, it's like the opposite. Moderates tend to kind of get both sides right. Conservatives also get it basically right, unless they're like so far off in the, you know, the right spectrum. But for the most part, conservatives get it right about how liberals think. Liberals do not get it right at all about how conservatives think.
That's very interesting.
And it's also, to me, that's anecdotally very true. Again, in my time at Harvard, I was always perplexed by some of the arguments when they thought they were making a conservative argument to persuade me. I'd be like, you really don't understand what we think. I have a couple examples if you want to get into them. But for the most part, they've never been in our bubbles. But for the most part, we have been in theirs. And I think that's an advantage. I don't know that we always use it mm-hmm. well enough. But I think you do. I think I do. But as a movement, I don't know that we have historically.
Yeah. I mean, I tell people a lot of the times that one of my greatest advantages is I understand the left better than I think a lot of them understand themselves. I've read their literature. I know what drives them or what doesn't drive them at times, because I think a lot of it is directionless. A lot of it, what drives the left, is directionless.
Well, I want to wrap up the Jonathan Haidt discussion, because I realized I didn't actually tell people the punchline or the bottom line of telling everybody the difference in the moral psychology stuff, which is this. So Haidt identifies five pillars, and I've named them briefly. I'll give them again. It's
different five pillars than
right. So caring and kindness is one. These are elements of morality. Mm-hmm. Okay, so caring and kindness is one. Sense of authority is another. Okay, so like how much do you care about a rule of law? How mm-hmm. much do you care about a hierarchy? Loyalty to in-group is another. I'm writing them down as we talk, so I don't like forget them. And I'm also trying to recall them in my own head. Loyalty to in-group is another. So like a sense of nationhood. Sanctity is another one. So that means like, what do you find to be gross? Like, would you wear a jacket that Hitler wore?
Well, of course not.
Right. But it doesn't make any rational sense. But there's like a moral grossness mm-hmm. that you feel when you wear that. So that's kind of like, that's sort of what he means by sanctity. And now I'm trying to like remember what the fifth one is as I look at my list. Again, I didn't know we were going to be talking about this.
That makes the best podcast of this.
I know. It's like caring and kind. Oh, fairness. Fairness. So that should really be number two.
Equity or fair with fairness.
Fairness and equity. Yeah. So that's
the word they use.
That's the last one. Equity. And we have different ways of looking at that. And so because for fairness and equity, conservatives and liberals both find this to be an important moral attribute. But the difference is this. Equity of outcome versus proportional equity, okay, or proportional fairness. So a conservative believes in proportional fairness, meaning if you work this hard, we think you should get this much. That just makes sense to me. A liberal is more likely to say, no, we find it more fair when everybody has the same thing. So we actually see that pillar a little bit differently. But here's the conclusion here and what he finds. Overwhelmingly, across a lot of different countries, liberals tend to vastly care most about caring and kindness and fairness. They don't even see these other attributes as even moral pillars. They score way down. For conservatives, they're all about equal. They're all equal. And so the conclusion I derive from this, and Haidt kind of mentions this in his book as well, which is the conservative approach to morality and the kind of society in general, civilization, is more complete. Mm-hmm. It's simply more complete because you can't ignore all of these things. They're all important. And the left would argue that really, no, only the first two, or only caring and kindness and fairness are important.
You know, as I – when I talk a lot about what conservatives believe and why we believe it, something I do struggle with and that I talk about is that it's hard for me to believe that some of the things that leftists believe can have any sort of moral justification. And, you know, we as conservatives, and we differ on a couple things, but we agree on all the big picture stuff and all the really important questions, is we do have an agreement on what is right and wrong. We do have an agreement on what is a nation state and how it should be preserved and protected. Mm-hmm. But I find it increasingly difficult to see how liberals could justify what they believe in any sort of objective morality. And that comes into the question of subjective morality. I think a lot of the left justifies what they do through a subjective moral lens.
It's not consistent, right?
Sure.
It doesn't appear to be anchored in anything. That's my big problem with it. And I always give this talk at your events, at Turning Point events, and because, you know, and it kind of goes something like this. We have these limiting principles that we should be able to quickly rattle off. And if you can't, well, you need to learn what they are. But the left has a couple, and I think I'm being very fair to them in this. They constantly say injustice and inequality. Like that, if you ask them what their philosophical underpinnings are, that's what they'll say. Those aren't limiting principles. And they're also very vague. Those aren't frameworks with which to govern. And that's my big problem.
They're also not ideals either.
No, they're not.
You can't strive towards injustice.
Right. You have to define it. And if you can, at least define it correctly. Like, that's all I'm asking.
Yeah.
And they don't define it correctly. Right? They call everything an injustice. You can define justice correctly.
Well, I think you can define justice. But injustice, to say that we are going to pursue towards the abolition of injustice, is just about saying that we're going to get rid of sin.
They're moving the goalpost all the time. That's my big problem with it. They're moving the goalpost. Again, you can find a rational definition of justice. Actually, Jonathan Haidt's book, Coddling of the American Mind, mm-hmm. my favorite definition is from him. And he basically – there's a couple different lines of reasoning. One is this. Justice means – or at least it means preventing person A from infringing on the rights of person B. Rights meaning life, liberty, and property. That's a very rational definition of justice, okay? And I think we would all agree on it. Here's another one, due process. Like a fair sense of due process, I think, would be a good way to talk about justice. Here's the third one. Justice would mean your efforts in a meritocracy, I think, result in an outcome that would be expected from those efforts, okay? Injustice would be your efforts compared to somebody else's are better efforts, and yet you still get a worse outcome. Okay, that would feel like injustice, and I think we would all agree on that. Mm-hmm. There's a rational definitions of injustice. The problem with the left, again, is they use those definitions when they're convenient, but they also use a million others, right? They're just moving the goalposts mm-hmm. all the time. That's my main problem with it.
With all the uncertainty in the world, feeling safe at home has never been more important. It's why I want to talk to you about Simply Safe Home Security. There are criminals on the loose. Break-ins are up 75% in New York City. They are releasing murderers back on the streets. So you guys got to be safe. If you don't have home security, well, it's on you. But there's a way to fix it. I want to tell you about Simply Safe Home Security. They're longtime friends of our show, and for good reason. Simply Safe has made it easy to finally protect your home against criminals. There's no technician or salesperson that needs to come and disrupt your house. You don't need to pay an outrageous monthly fee or sign a 2-year contract. You just order online. Set it up yourself in under an hour, and your home is protected 24/7 with emergency dispatch for break-ins, fire, and more. All for just 50 cents a day. 50 cents a day keeps the criminals away. That's a good deal, isn't it? SimplySafe.com offers that for you. So here's where you go. You go to SimplySafe.com/Charlie. And we're not the only fans of SimplySafe. U.S. News and World Reports named SimplySafe Best Overall Home Security of 2020. So head to SimplySafe.com/Charlie. Get free shipping and a 60-day money-back guarantee. That's SimplySafe.com/Charlie to make sure that they know our show sent you. From SimplySafe and all of us here wishing you safety from criminals on the loose, get safe, be safe, SimplySafe.com/Charlie.
So I have a question about psychology in general then, which is people are obviously predisposed through all sorts of different, you could say biologically or through nature or through nurture to either want to be very risk tolerant or risk averse. You're obviously on the spectrum. You're more willing to take risks and more willing mm-hmm. to believe in yourself.
Yeah.
And when the way I hear what you say is I was naturally conservative. What that means to me is you had a goal. You set out to that goal. You were obsessed about it. You had the rage to master. You held yourself to a very high standard. I think those are conservative beliefs inherently, mm-hmm. people that hold themselves to a high level of discipline and accountability. I find it very, very rare that people that say those things and act them out to be far left-wingers. Now, they might be socially liberal, but it's just they don't find any resonance in the kind of victimhood culture.
Yeah.
Here's my question,
That's
though.
True.
do you think in our country as it is today, do you think people more generally want to be free or be taken care of?
Ooh, I mean, this is my biggest fear, which is
this goes back to Hobbes, right? This goes back to, and I think Hobbes was right. I think that people are actually brutal savages when it comes down to it.
Yeah. Again, this is my biggest fear is that we keep asking what government can do for us instead of asking what we can do for our country. You know, that just that JFK line is so important. And yet we keep asking the wrong question about that. And yeah, this is my biggest fear. And this is my biggest message. And I often end with this message and talks it to students, which is let's let America know that we will not be the generation that is bought off. You can't buy my vote. We're always talking about buying votes. You know, we're always talking about corporate overlords. Like you mentioned it earlier, jokingly, like
they
the lobbyists with bags of money.
They don't have the piles full of cash.
Yeah, there's no piles full of cash. But also, you know, what does it mean to buy a vote, right? Like, are super PACs buying votes? It's all the dark money. Are they buying votes? Well, I mean, there isn't a single citizen that I'm aware of that gets a check from some dark corporate overlord and is told to vote a certain way. Now, they get advertising, sure. But guess what? You're a free thinker and you can choose to ignore that advertising or not. Here's how you buy votes most effectively. As a politician, you just promise people you're going to make them happy. You promise people you're going to end their suffering. You promise people you're going to give them free things. And if the other politicians weren't so mean, well, they would give you those free things too. And this is one of the biggest tricks played on the American people. It's as old as time itself. And you know, it's an Alex de Tocqueville quote where, you know, the end of the republic comes when politicians figure out they can buy people off with their own money. Mm-hmm. We're seeing it right now.
Well, like, you know, Cicero warned against this too.
I mean, these ideas are not new.
Yeah. You know? I mean, Cicero, who was a one-year Roman consul right before the end of the Roman Republic into the empire, was a famous author, is really kind of a celebrity of Rome. He warned – I mean, we actually get our three branches of government somewhat modeled after his writings. He said – if you are just going to just rob from the treasury mm-hmm. to give to the people, this whole experiment will flounder. So I right. guess I go back to this question, though. In America today, do people want to be free generally, or do they say that where they really just want to be taken care of?
Yeah.
I know that's a huge absolute question.
Yeah, but it's too generalized, too.
It's an important question.
No, it is. And this is why I say it's my fear, because I fear that we're turning into the – into that version where
the latter days of the Roman Republic.
Yeah. I mean, we see plenty of evidence of it, don't we? I mean, when conservatives are, and we should probably point to our own side on this, because, you know, I find it difficult for somebody to say they're conservative and get mad about wasteful government spending, but then demand, you know, higher payouts on their Social Security. Because I see that all the time. as a politician, I see this.
Do you
all
get
the time.
Those calls?
Yeah. Everybody wants government to spend less, just not less of the money that goes directly to them. Okay, so
everyone hates everyone else's government program.
Right.
What you're saying.
Yes, and we collectively as a culture have to fight back against that urge. You know, I tell the story in my book of when I got out of the military, and it was just mind blowing to me that I was. I think we talked about this last time on your podcast. If we did, I don't maybe want to repeat the story. But basically, when you're getting a disabled rating, leaving the military and getting medically retired, you're pretty much immediately eligible for Social Security disability insurance.
I think you texted me this. You didn't say it on my podcast.
I didn't? Okay. Well, here's the story. And I write about it in my book, which under the theme of victimhood culture and elevating that victimhood culture.
Well, if anyone has a license to say that, it's you. I mean, you're missing half of a vital organ, right?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm not trying to make you feel bad. I'm just saying, like, if anyone has license to say, like, feel
like
bad
one,
for me.
No,
right?
I was just kind of – I was going to nitpick. Like, it's more like one and a half because – anyway,
thank you for the correction.
So Social Security disability insurance, which I think most Americans would believe is really for people who are truly disabled and can't work. Mm-hmm. They need some kind of disability
the
insurance.
The least of
these.
Yeah, sure.
I'm glad we have that safety net. But everybody in that room, Navy active duty, who were all getting medically retired, everybody walked up and could hold things and see things and hear things. Like, these aren't even combat wounded veterans. So I found it odd that basically everybody, including myself, would immediately be eligible for nearly $2,000. You know, I never went through the process. I don't exactly know what I would have gotten, but I've researched it, and it'll maybe about $2,000 a month.
Wow.
until you get a full-time job. But why would you get a full-time job? Because guess what? Our retirement's – I think it's generous. Others might totally disagree with me.
What is
that.
Your retirement?
Oh, do I have to say it?
You don't have to say it.
Yeah,
I'm just curious.
I think it's very generous.
Okay.
Okay, for a 100% disabled veteran. I personally believe it's very generous. Others would really disagree with me on that.
So was this $2,000 on top of your already retirement?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
So we're already taken care of. And I just have a I just have a huge problem with this.
But most people don't.
This is the problem, because not only that, but I think it's cheered on in our current culture. I think this idea that you should apply for benefits that are somehow owed, and I'm doing little air quotes right now, owed to you, that's cheered. And it shouldn't be cheered. We're viewing heroism the wrong way. And what the other thing I note in my book is the
everyone buy it.
The Cinderella Man movie with Russell Crowe, where at the end of the movie, he returns that welfare check, right? He took a welfare check. And he goes through his hard times, he makes it again, and he returns the welfare. And this is a really prideful moment for him, to return that welfare check. But these days, that just wouldn't happen. You know, like that's just not the culture, it seems, anymore. And I think for millions and millions of Americans, it is. Like, let me not generalize here. But it's more and more the case, I think, that we elevate the opposite reaction. Mm-hmm. That we elevate the person who like protests their government office because they didn't get their check on time. And is that who we want to be? I loved the Queen's speech on coronavirus. It was like a month ago, it seems now. But it was one line really stuck with me. And she said, I hope we can all look back on this time and be proud of the way we acted. That was such the right message. It was so simple and short, mm-hmm. her quick message. But it was so good. And that's how I think we should always think about our lives. Is, you know, are we proud of the way we acted?
With currently no NBA, NHL, or Major League Baseball, you might think there's nothing to bet on. Well, you'd be so wrong. Our exclusive partner, BetOnline, still has hundreds of events, games, and props to wager on. From their online casino to poker and blackjack, as they are bringing the Vegas straight to you. Do you miss the NFL? No problem. BetOnline has daily Madden NFL 20 simulations you can wager on. If you're into entertainment betting, you can still bet on Survivor, Big Brother, American Idol, stock prices, and even the Nathan's hot dog eating contest, all open 24 hours a day. I love seeing the NFL draft. They're finally talking about bringing sports back. Go Cubs, go Ducks, go Bears. If you guys love sports, you guys got to get involved with BetOnline. It's so easy. We love them. That's betonline.ag. They're all open 24 hours a day and play all online. Visit the website or use your mobile device to join today to receive your new welcome bonus. BetOnline, your online wagering solution. Again, visit our good friends and exclusive partner at Podcast One, BetOnline, to take advantage of the best bonuses in the business. Sign up for a free account and make sure to use that promo code PODCAST1 for your sign-up bonus. Again, visit betonline.ag. Don't forget that promo code PODCAST1.
So let's go deeper philosophically, if that's okay with you. Whichever ethical system that is the most dominant in your life, it will instruct the answer to this question. Do you think people are naturally good or naturally bad or somewhere in the middle? I think that's fundamental to actually answering the previous question as well.
Yeah. You know, it is because the left and the right certainly view human nature a bit differently.
I think it's one of the most fundamental questions to politics.
And I think the premise of your question is that the left tends to believe that we can make humans better and kind
because
of conform
the
them.
Systems are broken,
right?
And human beings are broken because of the system.
So I think we understand that, like, you know, human nature can be brutal and evil. Like it just can.
I think it's naturally that way.
Yeah, and I think that we have to implement good structure. We do have to teach ourselves and engage in, like, a, you know, religion and use the church and use these old teachings, because it is. Yes. So the left tends to believe that it is always human-made institutions that are corrupt and that nature is always perfect. Like that comes from Marxist thought.
Like, and Plato presupposed it, and Rousseau was kind of the middleman there.
Sorry, it was Rousseau. It was Rousseau who said that.
Rousseau, social contract. Marx took it and turned it into an economic theory.
Right.
And Plato was kind of the pioneer there.
Yeah.
Aristotle completely disagreed with him.
Yeah. I mean, it seems obvious to me that that no, human nature is not naturally good, right? That it can be bad, yeah. And that our governing structures have to take that into account. And also, our governing structures have to live with a sense of humility. Mm. Like you can't control everything to the extent that I think the progressive believes you can control. And you have to allow that element of freedom and risk. Which is interesting because here's going back to the psychology, and we've touched on this a few times.
I think it's instructive for young people to hear this, though.
But I don't think we dove into this part, which is the whole risk aversion. And so some psychologists sometimes say that, okay, a conservative is by nature less risk averse, whereas the liberal is more risk confrontational.
I don't believe it that simply.
No, it definitely isn't. And it's also manifests the opposite in today's day and age with the coronavirus. You know, and so how do you explain that? And I think it is obviously more complicated than that because, oddly enough, it seems that the lockdown crowd versus open up the economy crowd has basically fallen completely on partisan lines. And there's got to be
some... But that's actually philosophical and psychological lines, yeah. Is what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be. I think a part of that is sort of corrupted by, again, the red and blue jersey wearing. You know, it's like, well, the president said this, so we're against it. Yeah. That might be part of it, but I think it is deeper. I think there is a deeper wiring that we're just wired differently.
So then, can I ask a question about that? How do you govern a country that's so psychologically different then?
Yeah. Well,
when you have communication platforms that cater to those psychological differences, right?
Oh, it's hard. I mean, it's getting harder as I think everybody's noticed. Well, I mean, how do you do that with a republic? That's how you do it. You make sure – because the worst way to govern a country like that is to make sure that 51% of the population controls a pure democracy.
Straight democracy.
That would be terrible.
Like ancient Greece, straight up. Yeah.
You will ensure that there's a civil war because as soon as one side gets 51% of the vote, mm-hmm. and then they start telling the other 49% what to do and they don't feel like they have power, they don't feel like they have a voice, could you imagine a worse outcome? A republic – maintaining the republic is so important. Those checks and balances, states' rights. Like people need to feel like, okay, fine, you guys are crazy over there, but I want to do my thing over here. If you don't allow that, that's sort of a pressure release. The way our republic is designed, it just that's why we've got to fight against these notions of changing the electoral college, of mm-hmm. adding more senators to big. And I come from a big state; I would get more senators. But is that really what we want? Like, I'm not so sure. You know, like we change these institutions at our own peril. They want to pack the Supreme Court. Just another example. Again, more power to the federal government instead of the state governments. These are elements of a republic that I think we absolutely need to protect. And it's also a good way, just by the way, for listeners, if you're trying to explain the difference to friends on difference between a Democrat and Republican, there's a lot of ways to do it. We've already gone through a lot of deep ways to do that just in this podcast. Here's another one. Democrat means pure democracy. Republican means protect the republic.
So can you explain what that means? I can, but I want to hear it in your words. Mm-hmm. Because I hear people saying, well, Charlie, why wouldn't we be a democracy? Everyone votes. It's equal representation. I've been taught from a young age that's what matters.
Right. And we are a democracy, but we're
we're a democratic republic, I think is a better way to put it. And we use democratic institutions to elect our leaders.
Right. Democracy means a lot of things, just like the republic means a lot of things. So here's what it means in this context. A pure democracy. This is why I said pure democracy. Meaning,
which is what
majority,
a Bernie Sanders,
majority
AOC,
rule. Yeah. 51% of the population tells the other 49% what to do. Mm-hmm. Like that, in the simplest terms, that's what it means. And I'm not building a straw man here. This is what the left keeps advocating for when they want to abolish the Electoral College and go to a popular vote. Okay, so that's one element of our government, the executive, mm-hmm. that would now just be a popular vote, no longer a federal Electoral College, but a popular vote. Okay, they want in the Senate, they argue the same things. They don't like the two senators from each state. Well, they don't like that. Now, they want it to be more like the House. And the House is a more national body, right? It is 51% majority rule, and that's fine. But we also have a bicameral legislature. So the Senate is a more federal version, two senators from each state, okay, because that allows less populated states to have more power. It balances the power more. If it was decided just like the House was, then why would we have a bicameral legislature at all?
We'd have a
There'd be no point.
House of Commons.
Right. It would completely undermine the entire system.
And I'd go a step further, and I think that and I'm very populist in a lot of ways, and you know that. And that's a different podcast for a different time. But I think one of the worst outputs of the populist movement in the early 1900s was getting the direct election of senators.
Right.
I think we were a lot better.
That wasn't what it was meant to do.
Well, senators were not supposed to go on national campaigns. They were supposed to be basically a representative of the state legislature.
Right.
And that we've lost that completely.
We did. And they've
17th Amendment or something. Yeah.
Yeah. They still got, you know, elements that obviously just make them distinct from the House, but that was a loss, I think. And our founders were not casual thinkers. they thought about this stuff really hard, and they were much better versed in thousands of years of government trial and error than probably anybody alive today. And you know, they thought these things for a reason, and that was a, you know, I think you said it right, that was a populist outcry that changed that. A lot of things changed back then.
And we got the income tax, yeah. Federal Reserve,
yeah.
World War I, and we got rid of direct election centers. And we had
banned booze.
And we had women's suffrage.
That was
a
good one.
Well, that was good.
At least that was a good one.
For the record.
Everything else kind of wasn't so great.
Yeah, exactly. So in the couple minutes we have remaining, everyone should check out your book. Is there anything you want to mention with your book? Now, it's doing well, New York Times bestseller a couple weeks in a row.
Should be.
What's Fortitude?
Yeah, just follow me on Instagram for the kind of the latest and greatest place to buy it, because it's sold out all the time. I think at this
That's
point
a good problem
you can
have.
Buy it on
That's
Amazon. Yeah, at least it'll be back ordered on Amazon.
Yeah. So just to kind of put this all together then, I have a lot of students that are still searching for – I have a lot of liberal friends and – I'm trying to find common ground with them, and I'm mm-hmm. trying to find agreement. I'm sure you get these questions all the time, right?
Yep.
And I might see this differently than you. I say stop giving leftists the benefit of good intentions.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think if your goal is to get mail-in voting, abolish electoral college, keep 3,000 abortions a day, just basically grow government to ridiculous levels, I don't think your intentions are good.
Yeah.
And I think you're trying to create something that is not – for the betterment of our country. What would you say to that when people say, well, yeah. They mean well, we just have a different way of getting there?
Yeah, it does depend on the issue, right?
And the person.
It depends on so many things. And so it's always hard to answer this question. You get it a lot. I get it a lot. It's hard to answer because it really does depend on the situation, who they're talking to, and are they talking to them in public? Is this an online debate? Is this a classmate
or
that you're
a
debating
or
in
a
class?
Sister?
Like
yeah.
it changes the dynamic for every single time. If it's some, so I'll try and quickly go through all of those situations and how I might look at them. If it's a friend that you don't want to lose the friendship with, or a family member you don't want to lose the friendship with, the best way to debate is usually to ask questions. Just ask hard questions, you know. And so if it's mail-in ballot, right, maybe the questions would go like this: like, what's your intent here? You know, like make them say it. Like, what is their intent? Well, I
and
just
then
want
just
everybody
let
to,
the pause speak
yeah,
for itself.
I just want everybody to vote easier. Okay, well, but do you acknowledge that there's a lot of space for problems to be had when you do mail-in ballots? For instance, if I go do voter registration based like door knocking right now. Inevitably, you'll come to some places that are registered to vote, and then it'll be non-citizens there. There might be empty lots, could be PO boxes. Like it's you know, and that's in 2020, and this happens all the time. And so that means if you just start mailing these people ballots, like maybe they think that they're supposed to get them, and they sign them, and they send them in. This isn't, yeah, it's voter fraud, I guess. But like these, you know, I'm not saying that there's some intentional mass voting fraud, but of course these mistakes can happen. And what happens then? Well, it means you're canceling out somebody else's vote. And doesn't that seem like a problem for you? Well, yeah, but we should have it. Okay, but don't you think that maybe our election should have some kind of security? Anyway, the point is just ask questions, right? It's a little less combative,
mm-hmm.
And you know, as opposed to confronting them right away with your position. That's with people you love and care about, and maybe you agree to disagree at some point. If it's in class, you know, maybe you go a little harder because, again, this is totally up to you because you don't want to be ostracized either, and I get that. But remember that you're not trying to persuade the person you're debating. You're trying to persuade everybody else listening. And maybe that goes the same for online debates too. So it always behooves you to not engage in character attacks, to don't question their intent. Even if you believe that you should be questioning their intent, don't do it in the debate because you'll just lose. You'll be more like them because they're the ones calling you racist and evil and whatever. Don't do the same, even if you feel like you need to. It's just not worth it as far as persuading others mm-hmm. who might be listening to that debate.
So I'll finish with this question that I ask almost everyone on the podcast. Do you think America will be more or less socialist in 10 years?
Less.
Good.
I'm going to be optimistic.
You're optimistic.
I don't think that we have, I think we've got a lot more going for us now than we did 5-10 years ago. We didn't have any of this 5-10 years ago. And so we didn't have Turning Point. We didn't have, Ben Shapiro's been around a while, but
he's
really
upward.
But he's really had it, upward inflection the last few years. I look back to early 2000s, mid 2000s. I didn't see up and coming conservative thinkers. I just didn't. And now I see a bunch. And
there's a whole community.
Yeah, I think there's a much stronger movement. We're late to the game, but at least we're here now. And so,
and the left doesn't really know what to do with us.
Yeah.
Right? And so, can you speak to that for a second? Because I'm sure a lot of these hyper-educated, verified people on Twitter, they find a lot of problems with you. Like, they get really angry at you, right?
Yeah.
Because you can actually make an argument.
Yeah.
And we're not supposed to be like that, right?
We're supposed to be like shallow talking points, kind of like they want us all to be old white boomers,
yeah.
You know, and it's like they don't know what to do with that. And they almost wish
we were like that.
Right. And what they don't realize is that, again, I know the liberal bubble. And like you said, like you study them. We know them better than they know themselves. I know what they're going to say every single time. And that's a huge advantage. It takes more work. Okay. And this is, again, going back to like, how do you debate the left? You have to do more work. You have to do more research because mm-hmm. they will come at you with emotionally charged arguments, and those are always very hard to combat. And another – here's maybe going back to some advice. Always take a step back and then frame their argument for them. Say like
– I want to make sure I'm understanding this correctly.
What I mean by that is, hey, let me point out what you just did there. Like you made a false equivalence or you questioned my intentions. I don't know why you did that. Like just that simple statement really puts it off. Like it mm-hmm. changes the whole dynamic of a discussion. And again, it depends on the discussion, depends on the moment. So it's really hard to give perfect advice on this. But I think hopefully that's helpful to anybody.
Well, to close this discussion, I think the answer to the question, will we be more or less socialist? It depends on people like us.
Yep.
And less on, unfortunately, there's been errors made in the conservative movement's past, but we have to do an even better job of telling people what we stand for and why we stand for it.
Right.
Because there is a value system. There are guiding principles behind why we believe what we believe. It's not just emotive.
Exactly.
It's not just rooted in hyper, feeling. The book is Fortitude. Congressman, this is a different discussion, I think, than we had last time, and it was great.
That's good. So it was good to be with you, Charlie.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Absolutely.
What a great time that was with Congressman Dan Crenshaw. If you guys want to get involved with Turning Point USA, as he mentioned, go to tpusa.com. That's tpusa.com. tpusa.com. You can start a chapter, chip in some money, get engaged or get involved on high school and college campuses across the country. We are dominating online. That is tpusa.com. Please support us if you can. $5, $10, $50, $100. Really help us out. Email me personally. You guys can email me. I check it all day, freedom@charliekirk.com, freedom@charliekirk.com. Give us some analysis links, things you want us to talk about. It's a direct line to be able to get to myself and those of us at the Charlie Kirk Show, freedom@charliekirk.com. And finally, please type in Charlie Kirk Show to your podcast provider. Make sure we have those 5-star reviews and make sure you are subscribed. When you subscribe to the Charlie Kirk Show, you help us surge in the charts. You help us beat the left. freedom@charliekirk.com. Hit that subscribe button. Thanks for listening, everybody. Go back and listen to our interview with Candace Owens, Nikki Haley, Governor Noem, Donald Trump Jr. Wow, we've had some amazing guests. Thanks so much for listening. God bless.